Synthetic biology. It sounds like an oxymoron. Which is it? Is it human-made or nature-made?
I think this could be a fun topic today. Synthetic biology is what matters on Discovery Matters.
In the first part of this episode, we're going to explore how synthetic biology can facilitate greater access to diagnostics. And our guide is Justin.
My name is Justin Weiger, and I'm a PhD student in Dr. Keith Pardee's lab at the Leslie Dann Faculty of Pharmacy at the University of Toronto in Canada. And in the Pardee lab, we address healthcare challenges using cell-free synthetic biology.
Justin was a great person to ask about the term synthetic biology because he grew up surrounded by nature and the outdoors.
I consider myself a conservationist at heart. I grew up in rural Western Canada, and being close to nature every day and wild animals was just a normal part of life. And then when I got older, moved, traveled, I realized that's extremely uncommon. So as I've gone through my university career, I've thought of ways that biotechnology may be able to help the conservation of biodiversity going forward. Conservation biology is extremely underfunded. So there are a lot of financial constraints with that. Additionally, conservation biology is done often way out in the field. So starting my career building low-cost medical diagnostics that are portable and can be used in the field, I find is a good start to a much longer career that will hopefully veer towards conservation biology, which is why I'm so focused on medicine and global health. We have a large network of collaborators in Chile, Brazil, Colombia, India, and in Boston. And we've been very focused on building COVID-19 centers since 2020 and 21. In 2022, we shifted towards using that platform to develop technologies that would be able to detect chikungunya, dengue, expanding our Zika diagnostics and malaria. And our collaborators in Chile, Dr. Fernan Federici's lab, is now using that same platform that we've all worked together on for so many years to detect invasive species in Chile. So now they're using those platforms that we built for COVID-19 centers that are now being applied to a broader suite of medical challenges to now conservation biology.
And this platform Justin's referring to, what is it exactly?
It is a paper-based diagnostic tool. And the tool is designed with low-cost, portable, freeze-dried biosensors embedded on a paper matrix. And that makes it both easy to transport and to use.
Okay, the marvels of paper-based diagnostics again. I assume this tool is tailored really nicely to low-income settings where there are remote areas which can't be supported by robust health infrastructure and so on. Is that right?
Exactly. And we're going to come back to the important angle of access.
So where does the sort of synthetic part of the biology come in?
One thing that's really amazing about working in the Pardee lab at the University of Toronto is we work directly in collaboration with mechanical engineers. So often we'll be building the paper discs, embedding them with molecular components, working directly with really talented mechanical engineers and fluidics folks, and they will build systems that will help integrate this into a healthcare application. So usually they're very simple 3D printed devices. And then we can add the paper chip to those. So rather than just reading one sample at a time, we can maybe read 8 or 10 or 96. So it makes it more of a scalable technology too.
Justin raised the importance of finding a middle ground, which this test was designed for.
Here in Toronto or in the global north, typically, we can go get a very accurate rapid RT-qPCR test. And that is extremely high throughput and very accurate. Or we can get a single at-home COVID-19 paper-based rapid antigen test. And they both have their place. But there's a clear need for a middle ground where we're not having these extremely accurate, extremely high throughput, extremely expensive RT-qPCR machines, but we also need a little more than shipping millions and millions or even billions of rapid tests. So that's where our platform lies, where we could embed molecular diagnostics onto 2mm paper discs, and then we can run 384 of these tests at a time. The tests usually take between 30 minutes and 1 hour. And the accuracy is comparable to what you would see in RT-qPCR. Some of our tests are 97, 98, 99% accurate, where we've done hundreds of different patient sample tests.
So this highlights areas forgotten in the conversations around diagnostics. This test could help tackling diseases that are more commonly prevalent in the global south, for example.
Yes, and Connor, I know that you get super passionate about this kind of topic, having grown up in the global south, having written before about the inequalities. And I think what's exciting is that there are areas in the global north where this could also provide useful.
So I like that because it means that the global north will develop it and the global south will benefit because there's something in it for both hemispheres.
Rural areas in the global north are sometimes forgotten in these conversations. For example, STD testing in northern communities or rural communities in the global north here in Canada, there's a huge divide. It's not only a divide between the global north and the global south, but there's also a divide between rural and urban. And I think that's a global phenomenon. It's simply not feasible to have a full laboratory in every rural community to do RT-qPCR tests on site. It's too expensive, and you need too many people to run them as well. You'd still need capacity to do molecular diagnostics. So our tests, they're much more simple to use than RT-qPCR. The accuracy is still very high, and they're much cheaper. These technologies will fill that gap.
So what are the next steps then in filling that gap, meeting the needs in these areas and putting these tests in the hands of the people that they can really help?
Well, I don't think it's going to surprise you to hear that in-region, for-region manufacturing is going to play a large role here.
We would like to decentralize the production of our tests. We still have to build some of these molecular components in Toronto or in Boston. And many of the components we have to buy, and they're quite expensive. Our tests are significantly cheaper than tests like RT-qPCR, but we can still lower the cost significantly if we shift our focus to developing the tests more closely to where they're needed and developing the molecular components on site. So now we're working really hard to build those molecular components ourselves and work with our collaborators in South America to make that happen, to make our molecular diagnostics more simple. So the less complex the cascade of molecular events that need to happen is, the cheaper and easier the tests become to make, and also they become quicker to get a readout. So it's a win-win-win situation. So I think we need to really focus on that, making sure these tests can not only be used in these rural areas or away from large urban centers in the global north, but they also need to be able to be developed and built more close to the areas where they're needed.
So this is something that we see across our industry more and more. It's better to manufacture locally, have local supply chains, and cater for local needs rather than having one single global distribution network and supply chain.
Location plays a huge strategic role in more than one way.
It's absolutely necessary to collaborate with scientists in the communities where these diagnostics are needed to ensure that the solutions are appropriate and that they address the need of the people in those areas. It's not only critical to build those technologies in the area or ship them from Toronto or Boston to these areas, but it's really key to have input and collaborate with local scientists in those areas so we're actually making technologies that will fit into what they need down there.
So here I guess we're going down another one of our little hobby rabbit holes, which is cross-disciplinary work. Is that right?
That is right. And these collaborations have a particular importance in figuring out a better way to increase access for such a diagnostic tool.
I don't think there's one solution. And the reason I say that is because I work with such a large group of scientists around the world, and there are many aspects to these projects, the molecular diagnostics, the ability to freeze dry them, the hardware that our engineers are building to work with these tests. And there have been postdocs and graduate students and PIs that have gone on in other areas, whether it be working for government health agencies, which is critical to have expertise there. We've also had some of our colleagues that have built these devices and spun them into startup companies. And then those startup companies have been bought by larger companies, and now they're lowering the cost further and selling those devices globally. But then typically the work I do is government funded, and it's more your traditional academic funding. So that's really important because it allows us to get these technologies from the ground to a place where we can actually start to do patient trials. But we are noticing where we are at the point in our technology where we do need to branch out. We do need to explore these other venues to see how best we can get this technology to where it needs to go.
Justin seems just so remarkably passionate, like so many of our interviewees. Was there an aha moment when he was designing this device?
I have one that screams to me, but it's not when I was in the lab. It's before I came to the lab, and it's one of the reasons I came to the lab. My background before I got into this was in RNA biochemistry. I studied the molecular mechanisms that govern protein biosynthesis with wonderful, wonderful biochemists in Germany and Canada. And it was really difficult to do fundamental biology on the ribosome, and it was very meticulous work. So when I discovered Dr. Keith Pardee and saw that he was able to embed these very complex macromolecular machines onto paper, freeze dry them, ship them to the other side of the world, add a drop of saliva, and have them reconstitute into a working synthetic biology device on paper from living components was absolutely mind-boggling to me. It's fascinating that you can take these components from microbes, embed them into paper, manipulate them to build a diagnostic, and to be able to distribute them. And it's completely juxtaposed to my experience working in an RNA biochemistry lab.
Whether across geographical or disciplinary borders, Justin sings the praises of working with, you guessed it, people.
For me, the success of this project was due to the focus on collaborations, establishing the relationships with all of these people around the world to build these technologies is the most important thing. The science is important too, but building relationships is extremely important to tackle these challenges in global healthcare. There's so many wonderful scientists on our team. Like I mentioned, I work in Dr. Keith Pardee's lab. We collaborate heavily with Dr. Alex Green at Boston University, Dr. Linda Marpena in Brazil, Dr. Camila Gonzalez in Colombia, and Dr. Fernan Federici in Chile. So it's really a huge collaboration on these projects.
Justin was wonderful to talk to, but when I asked about when he would be defending his thesis, he surprised me with a side story and something straight out of perhaps Hollywood or Bollywood.
I was planning to defend in September. However, we have an upcoming patient trial test in Colombia and in Brazil and in Chile to kind of finish all of this work we've done. We sent all of our reagents from Toronto down to Chile and all of our tests so that they could distribute across South America. And the entire FedEx truck was robbed. So we deal with a lot of stuff like this working in the field. We don't really have to worry about theft in our lab in Toronto, but as soon as we start taking things out into the world, it becomes a problem that we didn't anticipate. We would make the components here in our lab. So a team of PhD students and postdocs will purify the molecular components, embed them into paper, freeze dry them, and ship them. And the people in South America are building parts of it as well. We combine everything we built into these diagnostics on paper, and then we carry out the patient tests. So basically everything we sent down there, we need to remake or reacquire. So now all of the postdocs and graduate students will basically have to redo something. Theft happens everywhere. Like, you can go out on the street and there's pickpocketers all around it in large cities, but no one's typically in your lab stealing your pipettes, at least not at the University of Toronto. But as soon as you take them out onto the street, that becomes an issue that you may not have to deal with it in other scientific ventures.
Okay, so not the great train robbery, it was the great trial robbery. That's just annoying, isn't it? I mean, it's as if it's not hard enough, right, trying to make an impact. You get this kind of thing going on. So what about our next guests? Do they have any adventurous stories to tell like this?
Well, not to the same degree, but like Justin, they're all about synthetic biology. Our next guests have combined the use of synthetic biology and AI, another favorite topic on Discovery Matters, to develop a more efficient approach to finding and creating new antimicrobial peptides.
I am a postdoc currently in Paris at INSERM Institute, and before I was in the lab of Toby as a postdoc.
That was Amir Pandey, and here comes Toby, whom Amir was referring to.
I'm Toby Erb. I'm currently at the Max Planck Society at the Max Planck Institute for Terrestrial Microbiology, and I'm a synthetic biologist, a chemist and biologist by training, and I'm curious about expanding the capabilities of nature with synthetic biology.
How did Amir and Toby get together in the exploration of these antimicrobial peptides?
Well, as it does so often these days, it started with an email.
I received an email from Amir, who basically wrote me about our research, so it's always good to publish good places. And he came with the idea to actually use the tools of, let's say, computation and merge it with the synthetic biology research line in our labs. And I think this got me really excited because I think our lab is great in synthetic biology, but this element of using computation, machine learning is something I was sure would be important, but we didn't have it in the lab. And I thought this would be really a good fit for him and for our lab.
I had quite a freedom, and Toby let me explore my ideas. So before the project about antimicrobial peptides, I did another project using machine learning and synthetic biology. It was quite a different project, but that also shows the freedom that I had, unlimited support in the lab from material equipment, mind collaboration, and then that how actually ended up the idea and the project.
Synthetic biology is at the core of their work.
I think the last 100, 200 years, we have tried and we have really succeeded in understanding how our cells governed, what is DNA, what are proteins, right? And now we come to the point that we actually can make proteins which nature has not evolved. So we basically expand the solution space and we become creators with human knowledge. And I think that's the difference. It's not metabolic engineering or trying to improve something existing. It's really trying to create new stuff that could be helpful.
So Amir's no longer at the Max Planck, but he and Toby are still continuing to support and draw on one another.
Innovation happens at the interfaces. I think Amir has left his footprints in our lab. We have a machine learning tool that we routinely use now. So this is basically now part of our workflow. And we don't do antibiotic development in our lab, so we are not medically focused, but we care about sustainability. We care about conversion of carbon dioxide, creating new metabolic pathways. And the same tools that he has now used to develop these peptides, we can use to develop basically new pathways and also new proteins. And this is exactly where we're using his technology, but not interfering with his interest in the medical sciences. And I think it's a perfect matchup. So we don't tap on each other's foot, but we profit from each other. And we're in contact. So people from my lab typically reach out to him and ask him again about certain routines. And this is how we continuously improve and again profit from his expertise.
Toby sounds like our own chief technology officer, Beata Müller-Thiemann. She talks about...
She loves to say that. Absolutely.
That's exactly right, isn't it? She talks about innovation in those words precisely. So what was the upshot of Amir and Toby's paper?
Well, of course, they're going to tell us better. But in short, their work focused on establishing a cell-free protein synthesis pipeline for the rapid and inexpensive production of antimicrobial peptides.
When you have a peptide sequence and you want to see the activity of this peptide, what is usually done is that you do chemical synthesis. It takes time, it needs equipment, it takes knowledge. You have to be a chemistry lab to do this. Usually labs are biology labs if they want to create or test new antimicrobial peptides. And chemistry is limited, but is also quite expensive to order these peptides from companies. The powerful point of our paper was that I found this tool called cell-free transcription translation that I've been working since my PhD, that then I had the idea that we can train these peptides to produce these peptides into cell-free systems. So it's the case that you have a small piece of DNA that we order from, for example, DNA synthesis companies at very low cost, like $20 to $30, for example, a piece of DNA. Without any cloning or any treatment, the day you receive from the company, you can just pipette it into this cell-free transcription translation system. And after 2-3 hours, your peptide is produced, but you don't have to do any purification. You just directly take this solution and put it on top of the bacteria and to see how, if they kill bacteria or not. Doing this low cost and fast so that we could test a lot of antimicrobial candidates. In our case, we did 500, which to the best of my knowledge is the highest number of antimicrobial peptides tested in a single study. And then at the end, we found a 30 functional antimicrobial peptides. We actually only synthesized those that were functional.
I think Amir discovered a new continent. The natural solution space is like a huge sea. Right, you have small islands that nature has explored. These are the natural existing peptides. And I think he reopened up a new continent by using his combination of machine learning together with this kind of production in transcription translation. He really found new islands, new continents that nature had not explored before. And so really solution space has been really expanded quite a lot. And I think that's the power of his approach.
What Amir and Toby have done is open our ability to find antimicrobial peptides that can be functional and used for tackling global health issues such as antimicrobial resistance.
And then going into clinical trials with a functional peptide candidate means less risk to the trial. It'll be more pathogen specific. And of course, there is a higher chance of success, accelerating the whole drug discovery and development process.
That's right. And you know what they say about a good strategy is that it is as much about what you won't do as what you will do. And so this work has also helped our guests observe what is not a good peptide.
And this is something that we don't see enough of in clinical trials. It's so important that we have the negative data as well. It's not just the successes, it's the failures that matter so much, especially now that we've got AI as a partner in discovery. We've got to be able to feed the machines with our failures as well as our successes. Otherwise, we won't learn.
By creating things that fail, you actually can improve this design. It's like you as a child, when you learn your language, you do a lot of mistakes and you're corrected automatically. So a lot of peptides are mistakes, but in these iterative cycles could be corrected and you can come to much better and more proficient, more efficient peptides in the future. I think that's really the power, that you can increase the numbers, which increases the learning aspect here.
Even though they're no longer at the same lab, Amir and Toby are excited about what's next.
The advances in AI, like the generative tools, the generative deep learning, when we started this project, it was before AlphaFold. So now for new generative models, a new wave in all this generative AI, so we can also equip our biology knowledge with more advanced AI, and also from the other hand, equip our synthetic biology tools. And I think for me, the future for this research line is quite bright, at least for me. It excites me, and it gives me the vision to do research.
I've learned to be really technology open and seeing that certain technologies can advance science as such, right? And sometimes you have to invest and you're not sure if this works at the end of the day or not. It was a risk, right? It was a bet, but I think we learned a lot along the way. And I think it's very important that we try to push the boundaries, biologically speaking, but also technologically speaking. And then there is the beauty that sometimes these two things co-align and you open up new doors.
So in this episode, we've explored how synthetic biology has the potential to bridge the gap in diagnostics across the global north and south, and how AI can be used to discover new antimicrobial peptides more quickly and at a lower cost. This is just progress. It feels like progress, Dodie. It's a nice thing to be recording on a Friday morning, isn't it?
It is great.
Now, every day, as we say, is a school day. What have you learned this week?
What I learned recently relates to our synthetic biology topic, and the headline from science.org is that a monoclonal antibody rescues mice from snake venom. So this terrible problem around the world about snake bites, currently treated by really good anti-venom, but that kind of anti-venom can result in serum sickness and anaphylaxis. So it is a problem that scientists are looking to solve, and Kallik and all used a synthetic human antibody library to find and optimize a MAB, a monoclonal antibody, that could neutralize long-chain three-finger alpha neurotoxins produced by snakes such as cobras, crates, and mambas. So what's interesting is from the snakes themselves, they're able to synthetically create a cure for what the snakes themselves are causing. So this is a high-quality anti-venom matched to the biting snake species, and it was effective at reducing morbidity and mortality in mice. Quite cool.
That is fun, isn't it? And works in mice. I love that. I mean, it seems like so much works in mice. And if mice were men, oh, wouldn't that be a great thing? I've learned something rather disturbing this week, and this is about, it's AI related, but it's generative AI related rather than investigative AI, as our scientists have been using in this episode. And this is about the generation of propaganda by AI. And the study published in the Journal of the National Academy of Sciences by Goldstein and al. Says that large language models can be used to generate persuasive propaganda, and worryingly, this generative AI created propaganda is just as effective as propaganda created by humans. So that just has me concerned.
Yeah, we're entering the age of deep fakes, and there's enough happening in the world where, you know, we need to come back to the original journalistic method of verify with two unrelated sources.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what worries me most about this is the fact that we've now got access to large language models that can generate at speed multiple different disinformation and misinformation items of propaganda, and that can proliferate very, very fast and be propagated online by AI-driven bots as well. And in a year like this, where we've got so many elections going on, and the opportunity for misinformation and disinformation to really cause havoc in liberal democracies, we've got to keep and maybe educate ourselves and our friends, colleagues, peers, children about where and how to get access to trustworthy information.
As they say, let's be careful out there. Our producer is Beth Armit Brewster, editing, mixing, and supervision by Banda Productions, and music from Epidemic Sound. My name is Dodie Axelson.
And I am Connor McKechnie. Make sure you rate us on Spotify or whichever platform you use to listen. The algorithm helps us. We'll see you when we come back with another episode of Discovery Matters.
Bye for now.